Good afternoon and welcome to the Sitka Nature Show. This is your host, Matt. I want to thank you for joining me here on the last day of November 2025, just about 3 weeks away from winter solstice. Definitely, we are into the dark part of the year, but that doesn't mean nothing's happening out there in the natural world. 2 weeks ago today, if you're listening to this live, a dickcissel and a Harris's sparrow, two very unusual birds for Alaska, showed up in my yard. Turns out they'd been in the neighborhood for a couple of days at least. Caused some excitement around with some visiting birders, and this week's conversation is one that I recorded with one of those birders. Zach Polin is an avian biologist and birder, and he came to Sitka to visit, and I recorded the conversation while he was here just about 2 weeks ago. So we'll go ahead and join the conversation with him introducing himself and go from there.
I am a avian biologist, but I'm also a bird watcher, and I like birding all over the world, but in particular, I like birding in Alaska, and I'm here in Sitka to look for a particular bird.
So, yeah, we had a Harris's sparrow and a dickcissel show up in my yard yesterday, actually. Dickcissel is only the third state record and first ever for Sitka. The Harris's sparrow has been seen quite a few times around the state, I think, but still very rare bird. It's been 25 years since one's been seen in Sitka. Neither bird had you seen before. Dickcissel, I mean, maybe somewhere else, but not in Alaska.
I've seen probably thousands and thousands of both of those species, not in Alaska, but for us that have these new boundaries that we follow, yes, I've seen neither of those in Alaska.
That's one of the funny things about birding and the interaction of birds and political boundaries.
Absolutely. And it's, I think it's, we're all trying to play the same game so we can compare against each other, you know, because there's a competitive spirit in many of us. And once you get a new area, no matter how big it is, whether it's Sitka, whether it's Anchorage, or if it's Alaska or North America or all these things, there's always these fringe candidates that you're trying to find common birds in other areas that when they make it into your own. And that's what drives people to do some things that maybe are questionable to others, where you're flying to Sitka to see two birds in somebody's backyard.
I mean, flying to Sitka is always a good idea, but you know, I'm a little biased there. So, it is kind of funny. Like, you could probably take a trip to Japan for cheaper than you could go to Gambell in many cases and see the same bird, some of the same birds anyway, or, you know, other places in Asia, but they wouldn't be North American birds. So, and there are the people that are the world birders. I mean, not that long ago, somebody, I think it was the first person, of course, this is subject to taxonomic changes and whatnot, but they crossed 10,000 species worldwide for the first time.
Yes.
Which is a remarkable feat. And there's I don't know what the current record is for world big year, but that's a whole different thing. Like in North American big years, you're chasing vagrants. Mm-hmm. I mean, you got to get all the common ones and then you're chasing vagrants. Mm-hmm. You're going to South Texas and Arizona and Florida and the Bering Sea and the Northeast, you know, Maine or wherever. Or actually, I guess Canada, New Brunswick and those kind of places, Nova Scotia. In a world big year, you don't care. Vagrants are absolutely irrelevant because it's like, find the bird where it's common. But you got to maximize, you know, that only got so much time and there's a lot of world to cover. So when Nora Stryker did it, I followed his blog that year, and it was fascinating to just like, it was way more work probably in the end, but kind of the feeling of it was different because it was just about going to where the birds are, not trying to chase these vagrants.
Totally a different strategy than for doing a Alaska big year or North American big year. It's a totally different strategy, and there's a lot more work on you to find your birds as opposed to relying on other people to find birds that you end up going to chase.
Yeah. I guess you're picking good guides in places with a lot of diversity, because it's hard, you can't know those birds when you go.
Absolutely.
Especially you get into South America and the crazy diversity that they have there and the difficulty of distinguishing.
Just owning all the field guides in itself is like, you know, all library.
You can't carry them.
Yeah. Yes, exactly.
I guess you could carry them in your phone these days. But so you mentioned that you're an avian biologist and a birder. I guess, is that typical, or are most avian biologists in your experience, you know, they like birds presumably, or they wouldn't be studying them, but not really birders necessarily in the sort of the way that we most often think about birders?
That's a good question. I think actually, it's unique. There is very few people that I think are maybe listing sort of bird watchers that are really active at going out and looking for birds and recording birds that also are biologists. But I will say that all of my biologist colleagues are also, they're passionate people that care about birds.
Yeah.
But, it's an interesting Venn diagram between the two, and not, it's a small area between both
where they're actually birding as a hobby. Like it's a professional, hobby. They got other hobbies basically.
Exactly.
And you're kind of like, I'm all in.
Exactly. And yeah. Sometimes, you know, it depends on what kind of biologist or ornithologist or maybe you're a geneticist and maybe that's what you're more interested in, not necessarily the birds. So there's different types of biology that you can do with birds that overlaps less. And you know, a lot of the work that I do is a lot of field work. It's out actually going out there and counting, looking at and identifying, which overlaps a lot more with actual, you know, bird watching as opposed to maybe spending time inside
in the lab
or, or whatever.
Yeah.
That you don't necessarily have to be a birder or you don't have to be have those skills to identify birds to do your job.
So when you're doing that, I could imagine that people are doing the work that you're doing. You're like, okay, I've scanned enough flocks, you know, counting gulls, figuring out species or whatever the species might be, that I don't really want to do that in my spare time as well. But I know you've, you know, you traveled here. You told me earlier today that just yesterday you did a 5.5 hour each way drive to see a state first record broadwing hawk in Valdez, was it?
In Valdez, yeah.
Yeah. And earlier in this fall, you went to Middleton Island, which is an undertaking in of itself. So clearly, yeah, I wouldn't say there's something wrong with you. Maybe there's something right with you that you managed to find a career where you get to do this all the time and get paid for it. And then in your spare time, use that money that you earned doing it to do more of it in even more remote places.
Yeah, it's... I think this just gets discussed a lot with folks whose hobbies start to blend into their careers, where you don't want what makes you happy to feel like work. And, you know, sometimes it's okay to keep them separate. But, yeah, when you can also always feel like you're not working because you're so passionate about it, that's like the sweet spot that it never feels like you're going to work because it's something that you do for fun all the time. I like it. With work, it's often I'm going and doing these things in places that are dictated to me. You know, like, you need to do this at this spot. For a hobby, I do it where I get to dictate where I want to go. I get to pick those locations. And they usually are different than the places that I do for, that I would visit for work. You know, going to remote islands or places that are unique, or chasing birds, like coming to Sitka or going to Valdez. My job would not send me there to go do that, but it gets me to new places. I get to see new places. Birds are just one kind of avenue to kind of enjoy a new experience at a new location. So there is additional things you gain from chasing birds and going to new places to look for them. It's not just the birds you see, but it's the whole kind of environment of it.
It's interesting to think about, certainly any birder that is very serious about listing. Some of us, I'll just say broadly, are remarkable in our ability to be excited about that bird that we see every day. And it, you know, the belted kingfisher. And it's just like, it's there. It's just as cool today as it was the, you know, first time I saw it 47 times ago, you know, and I'm still excited to see it every day. Some of us are like that. I'm not necessarily, like, I like seeing the same birds again and again. I don't get that excited about it. Novelty is fun. I like, especially novelty in a context where it's like, yeah, a Harris Sparrow or a Dick Sissel that show up in my yard yesterday, really exciting. I could easily see all of those that I wanted if I went somewhere else. Mm-hmm. But the fact that it's here, you know, makes it kind of special in a way. And knowing that bird's like not where it belongs, and there's all of that that goes into it. But in some ways, that's just like the polar opposite of like when you're doing avian biology. Like, that's just noise and irrelevant to sort of the concerns of populations and understanding the biology of these birds in terms of where they're migrating. There are interesting questions about vagrancy, what might cause that, but it's kind of on the margins, it feels like, of concerns about conservation and that kind of thing. Presumably vagrancy is not significant in terms of conservation, although I suppose in some instances, you know, there could be founder mm-hmm. situations where enough vagrancy happened to establish a new population in a different place. Although mm-hmm. that's probably still pretty rare. But generally speaking, birder types, especially listers, are like, yay, new species, hooray for vagrants, it's vagrant season, vagrant traps, we're looking for all these rare birds that are, you know, maybe one-offs, all the better if it's a one-off, it's mm-hmm. even that much more special. And as an avian biologist, you're probably like, well, I like to see those because I'm a birder, but irrelevant to my data collection and objectives in terms of science.
Yeah, absolutely. There's a lot of what I do is, you know, is being involved with coordinating long-term monitoring, and this is really looking at how populations are doing over time, how a species is doing over time. And having one bird show up once, we just don't have the data to make any sort of inference based on that. So the summer months, where we are dealing with a lot of understanding how our breeding birds are doing, how these birds are faring over decades, the vagrant doesn't matter. It's all about ensuring that you're counting and documenting the common or slightly uncommon birds in areas, and kind of doing that over a large scale, over, you know, the entirety of Alaska. So while maybe not as exciting, because it's not just like a, you know, unusual bird for the location, there is this weight that every observation there is adding to this greater goal, is getting to this ability to be able to monitor these species, to monitor their health, to see how they're doing, see where they're doing well, see where they're doing poorly, with the end goal of seeing how we can make sure that we're not letting birds disappear from our landscape so that they're here for everybody in the future. So, yeah, it is probably like different parts of you that kind of get excited different parts of the year when I'm wearing a different hat, be a bird watcher or a biologist. But no matter what, they're always unique. They're always cool. They're always interesting. You just kind of have to think about which way are they interesting to you at that moment.
Well, and that's one of the things that I've appreciated about birds, and not, you know, in our conversation earlier while we're sitting around watching for birds that didn't show up. You know, you mentioned that the one of the nice things about birding sort of under the large umbrella, not everybody views it that way, but like this large umbrella understanding of birding is, it's, you know, everybody from the person who maintains one hummingbird feeder and just loves the hummingbird, couldn't tell you what species there is, and if a different one showed up, they wouldn't necessarily know, but they love the hummingbirds. Mm-hmm. And that's enough. And, you know, it doesn't have to be any more than that to the maddest hardcore lister that doesn't care what they see, as long as somebody saw it well enough for them to check it off their list. It's all about the checklist, and, you know, the birds are just happen to be the vehicle which allows them to add a check to the list. And, you know, they could just as easily be collecting model cars or something like that. I don't mm-hmm. know. But for whatever reason, they chose birds. And so, like within that, there's this broad expanse of hobbyists and obsessives and things that are folks that are doing these activities related to birds somehow. And you know, I think sometimes having thoughts and feelings about conservation, so the work that you're doing, which is, you know, by most birder standard, probably not that exciting. You know, yeah, if I can see the spectacle of all the snow geese on the nesting grounds or something, great. But do I want to stand there and cast, you know, count nesting success in snow geese on the North Slope with all the mosquitoes? Mm-hmm. No, probably not my idea of a good week or month or however long that it takes, you know. And so there are definitely, you know, aspects of that. But then if I have sort of a familiarity with birds, I'm like, oh, I've seen snow geese. They migrate over, and, you know, we don't get that many of them here in Sitka. I know there's lots more over like the Stikine River. That's a major stopover for them, but they're nesting on the north. They're wintering. I spoke with a biologist that works with in California, Central Valley, had happened to band and collar a white-fronted goose that showed up here at Swan Lake a couple years ago. And so she was telling me about the work that they do in California, where they have gazillions of snow geese in the winter. Actually, more of that population's increased by
it's
a bunch.
Exploding. Absolutely.
Because
exploding.
In part because of the agricultural fields, I guess. And so, you know, for better and worse, you know, there are human reasons that some of these things are happening, for better and worse at times. But now that that has, like, I have a connection with that because I've seen them here. It's something that I recognized, and, you know, concerns about whether they're doing well or poorly on a population, like there's a sort of a personal entryway to me. And I suppose in your concern as a biologist, you know, that's probably part of what you're working towards, is understanding, I imagine, these things so we can make good management decisions, so we can make regulations that are helpful and not too onerous, but also, you know, not deleterious to populations, and trying to thread that needle. And then on the birder side, it's like, yeah, but because I care about these, because I like the birds, you know.
Yeah, there's a lot to unpack there.
Fair enough. Yeah.
But you know, there's a lot of components of why we monitor birds, why we want to monitor birds, that, you know, what we're trying to get out of that. And it's to make sure the birds kind of persist for all of our future generations. But there's, when you're a bird watcher and you can observe these things, I think birds are a taxa that's very relatable. They're usually easy to detect. They're very vocal. There's not so many that it's overwhelming. I'm sure, you know, dealing with lots of other things like beetles and grasses and sedges and stuff, it's overwhelming. You could argue that you don't necessarily deal with that with birds, where, you know, on a small scale, maybe there's only 200 that might be at play anytime in Sitka in a year. Or, you know, globally, if we're dealing with 11,000, it's like, it's enough that you could spend your whole life studying them, but not so much that you feel maybe overwhelmed with the ability that you'll never get there. So that's kind of, I think birds are unique in allowing people to connect with nature maybe better than some other taxa. And once they connect, what can we do about it? You know, where's the next step? Once you appreciate the birds in the in your environment, where do you go from there? And I think, you know, you mentioned it a little bit about this monitoring that we do is, you know, to make these sort of regulations. But I think there's a lot of monitoring that we do to just understand the system. And then there's lots of things that we can do to all be a part of bringing these birds back. Unfortunately, a lot of the work that we've been doing in Alaska and across North America has shown that so many of these birds have been disappearing since the 1970s. We've lost 3 billion birds during that time period. And now that we know that, what are the next steps that we take to help change that? And there's certain things that you can do, maybe from a regulatory perspective, but there's a lot of things that you can also do as a person to kind of change these things. There's like 7 simple actions that you can do to help bring birds back. And these have been, many people have probably seen some of these, but these are steps that we can all take to kind of do a little bit of our own part. And whether it's participating in citizen science, participating in eBird, iNaturalist, drinking bird-friendly coffee, having bird-friendly glass on your windows, using less plastic. These are all these simple steps that have been identified as, if everybody kind of participates in these, we can have actual changes at the population level. A lot of the work that we do is kind of watching these, sometimes these birds decreasing, but the end goal is really to change behaviors and to try to bring these birds back so that they're not disappearing on our watch.
Yeah, that makes sense to me. And I suppose, you know, just yard habitat is another thing that isn't, and, you know, in some places, cats, I suppose, are another.
Yes, keep cats indoors.
Big challenge.
Use less pesticides. Yes.
Yeah, but just having, And around Sitka, it's not as big a deal as I imagine is some other places, because there's a lot of folks that aren't really big into their manicured lawns here. Mm-hmm. but it is, mine's a little wilder than most even still, but the birds really like it, you know, especially add some food there. They have lots of little cover to go. And so it is handy that way. I don't know, you know, so many of our migrant birds, our nesting birds are going south for the, you know, and so sometimes it seems like, well, the issues end up being where they're wintering. But we do also have wintering birds. That's one of the nice things about Sitka in particular, is we have resident birds. We have several species, quite a few species that are year-round residents. We have, but we also have this big changeover, you know, songbirds. We don't have a huge diversity of songbirds that are nesting here, but, you know, thrushes and warblers and sparrows that are mostly not wintering here. And then in the winter, we have all these waterfowl that come, not just waterfowl, but loons and water birds, I guess we should say. And some of those are also resident, the alcids and so forth. But like loons, few loons are resident, but many of them are migrants. Waterfowl, most are migrants. And so we get this different set of diversity. And yeah, it just makes me think, oh, well, you know, I don't know how those populations are doing. I know that there's challenges for habitat and things in Central America in many cases. Like, I suppose that's where the coffee thing comes in, and mm-hmm. and helping to support habitat for some of these warblers, especially, and mm-hmm. other migrant songbirds. But I guess that gets a little bit out of the way. Like, you can impact that indirectly through purchasing decisions, but and then I suppose there's ways that people can support conservation efforts in those areas, you know, contributing to organizations that are working towards that or whatever, but it's a little further removed. But we can make it easier for them to do well here. Mm-hmm. You know, the better that they better nesting success they have, the more of them there are. Mm-hmm. You know, and so it is interesting just getting to know them and getting to know the birds in your yard. Really, is like there's something really powerful about doing that, and even to the point at times of getting to know individuals. I know that some folks do that. I don't spend enough time in my yard. I like to walk around a little too much for that. But yeah, that's an interesting way to kind of get to know. There's somebody around the corner from me has hummingbirds, and she's like, "Well, that's the aggressive male. He likes to chase off all the other ones, and he's bossy. But sometimes he leaves, and then these other ones come in, and you get to kind of know him a little bit by their attitude, I guess, and behaviors."
I think you mentioned it earlier today, but talking about, it's so much easier for somebody to become invested by seeing the individual, by seeing the, it's hard to be invested kind of at knowing that, you know, this entire species has been declining over 50 years. But when you can actually see an individual, one of those birds in your backyard, you know, at your feeder, or, you know, foraging on your lawn or something, you can kind of feel it a little bit more. You can kind of see the bigger picture through that one individual. And sometimes making differences is making differences on the many people making differences on an individual level kind of makes a bigger change.
Yeah. And it's interesting, like you mentioned some of the work that you do, and I know you work with eBird a lot in Alaska, that some of the things that you're able, the mapping that you're able to do, the population trends and those sorts of things, these big scale things that are much, you know, well beyond our ability to kind of, most of us, to personalize, but we make that relationship with the hermit thrush that comes to our yard, or Swainson's thrush that comes to our yard every summer and singing from the top of our tree. And then we look at the maps of like, oh, where are they going? You know, when are they traveling there? And it starts to, because you have that relationship with that one bird, you know, then you start to feel connected to this whole, like, this whole bird's life, you know, life history, kind of life cycle, a cycle of the year, yearly cycle that it's doing, coming up here, and it's really only here for maybe 3 months at the most. And then maybe it's spending a month migrating each way, and then the other 7 months of the year, it's in this other place. So that's really probably its home. Mm-hmm. It's coming here for a visit kind of thing. But you start to, you're able to do that. But that data is not so easy to come by either. I mean, eBird is a rather remarkable innovation, I guess. It's been around for 20 years now, pretty close to.
Yeah.
And, you know, it's gone through some iterations over the, I think I first remember looking at it around 2007, but didn't, had other things that I was using to record my information and didn't start using it until about 5 years ago more consistently. Mm-hmm. but I know that there's, I don't know, million, probably hundreds of millions of records at this point. Mm-hmm. In
I think Ebert. We just passed 2 billion.
2 billion, fair mm-hmm. enough, yeah. So many, many records that, you know, are mostly, almost, I'm assuming the absolute vast majority of them are just done by interested folks, not by mm-hmm. professionals, observing what they see around them because they enjoy doing it or mm-hmm. because they like the list or because, you know, whatever reasons motivate them. But yet that data is able to kind of swirl together and through the alchemy of statistics and data analysis, you know, and filtering, you know, stuff is able to get pulled out that's meaningful and allows us to, you know, understand in ways that it's really difficult to do without that kind of data.
Yeah, we're honestly, it's this, what Ebert is providing us is kind of unprecedented. We've never been able to know the secret lives of birds like we do with Ebert. And the only way it works is if we have buy-in from all of the citizen scientists, all of the people that are out there watching birds in their backyards or in their local areas, and bringing it all into one place where they can all talk together. So, you know, you mentioned how you can, when you observe a bird, you can start caring about maybe the population more. But now what you can do is you can observe a bird, you can record that bird through an eBird checklist, and you can actually be a part of our understanding of the abundance and distribution and the trends of that species. You can be a part of understanding how the species is actually doing over time. And it helps the individual kind of be a part of the science and feel like they're being a part of something bigger. And when you are doing that and you're doing that with a million other e-birders, bird watchers around the world, you can kind of feel like you're part of a little bit of a community there, that together we're able to kind of make these, make something that teams of biologists are never, have never been able to do. We just never have the coverage. We never have the temporal coverage, you know, throughout the year, or the spatial coverage, how much area we're actually covering compared to a program like eBird. So it is extremely powerful when we can bring everybody together to kind of do something, and in this case, do something for the birds.
Yeah, it's been remarkable over, especially the last few years, I think, as the data volume has grown and the sophistication with which it's able to be, and probably the computing power.
Absolutely.
A big part of that, to be able to be analyzed and rendered into visualizations and things. I know in the old days, you know, there was very simple, like, track the hummingbirds as they move north. And there was a site that, you know, people go on specifically for mm-hmm. hummingbirds and rufous hummingbirds in the west and ruby-throated hummingbirds in the east. And you could see, oh, they're in Washington. And, you know, of course, there's such a gap between Washington and Southeast Alaska in terms of population density. So, you know, to be in Washington, it's like, okay, when's the first one going to show up in Ketchikan or Sitka or something like that? So it was always, it was kind of fun. But eBird allows you to kind of do that with all the things.
Almost, you know, all the birds that exist on the planet, we're able to kind of start looking at that. Some we don't have a lot of data for currently, but for a lot of birds in North America, what you were just talking about with our hummingbirds, you know, we're able to track them. We're able to now track how these birds are moving every week of the year. And there are relative abundances in those areas. So extremely powerful what eBird is providing us, just from kind of simple checklists too. This isn't something that's you need to go out and spend 12 hours of your day recording all these birds. It's, you know, have a coffee on your back porch and count the birds that are in your backyard for 10 minutes. That is incredibly valuable information, because when you combine that with a million others, you start to have these really precise pictures of what's happening every week of the year.
Yeah, I know there's somebody in town that does almost daily bird sit. I think I'd see their checklist come in, and it's usually the same mix of, I mean, it seasonally varies, but mm-hmm. I'd be like, I could just tell from the checklist probably who that is, because I look at the checklist and without even, if I just saw the list of species, I'd go, I'll bet, and the counts, I'll bet I know who that is. And, but that's, you know, there's something valuable about that also because of the structure and the consistency, you know. Mm-hmm. I don't do that. You don't have to. You could do whatever you want.
Absolutely.
As much or as little as you want. If you report everything that you are able to identify, that's helpful to know. If you're just like a lot, most of my day's checklists are just like, oh, what are the birds that I, at the end of the day, I'm thinking, what did I see today? And I put incidental because I remember most of the birds, but it's easy to see something and just happen to forget about it or whatever. So that is, you know, that gives you some presence absence data and that kind of thing, but doesn't necessarily allow for abundance trends and those sorts of things. And but it is, it all kind of goes into the wash. And for me, I get something out of it because I enjoy knowing how many birds I saw this year, for example, you know, what, how many species I saw. And I enjoy seeing how it compares year to year. And it's actually interesting. Up until I started, I think the second, I started using eBird more consistently in 2020. And in 2021, I think that's when I like really went in. And up until then, my highest species count, I think, was 161 locally. But since then, and I don't know if it's just because of eBird, but I don't think so. I think it's also because more people have been seeing more stuff. And I think I've also been able to get out on the water more. But I've had consistently higher species counts in a year. But eBird does make it easier to keep track. And then to also see, oh, that one that I could have gone and seen, I haven't seen yet this year. Maybe I'll make an effort. So I think there's that aspect of it as well. But I happen to like making numbers go up. You mm-hmm. know, I understand that's not really that big of a deal, but it is motivating for me. And so it feels like kind of a win-win. I was like, well, eBird's helping me keep track of this stuff. And it's easy to do if you, it sounds like most people use their phone. I use my phone sometimes. You just pull up the app and you start putting in the birds. And then even with Merlin now, you can use that to help you identify, especially by sound, some of them. And although it does warn you, don't just use Merlin. Sometimes Merlin makes mistakes, which it does. But it often does pretty well. And it's really pretty straightforward. And to do that wherever you go in the world, that's the other thing. If you're interested in birds, you know, it can get challenging to identify things when you're out of your normal range, but that's part of the fun.
Yeah. One of the beauties of eBird is it is very flexible. And it's flexible to the point where it allows you to participate in at a level that you feel comfortable. You can keep pushing that level up to make it your observations as scientifically valuable as possible. But maybe that's too onerous and you don't feel comfortable doing that. You can bring it down to what you feel like doing. And that allows, you know, the science aspect of it to kind of pick and choose what information they want to include in their analyses and their model building and which ones they don't. But like you mentioned, eBird is really good at organizing your observations. It's really good at saying, okay, these are the species that you saw in Sitka, or these are the ones you saw in Alaska, or, you know, some other county in the lower 48. And a lot of people, they're motivated by it. They're motivated by seeing their own numbers increase, and they're also motivated by seeing how their numbers compare to other people. And that is kind of the carrot that I think eBird is providing here, where it's giving you this environment to see your records, to see all of your stuff summarized and in one place. But that's the carrot, so that they get your observations. And they can use your observations for science, for, you know, helping birds. But you kind of, which you may also appreciate, but you also get this thing on the side where you kind of have all of your things organized in one place, which is extremely valuable with birds because taxonomy is changing constantly. So, you know, one year, maybe the two species you saw are going to be one the next year, or they're going to be split. And keeping track of that is a very complex endeavor. And having a program like eBird kind of help you do that is valuable to a lot of people. Especially if you're a world birder that's seen thousands of species and sometimes one only once. trying to remember, you know, 8 years ago if I saw this one or that one, or in how it's been split since then from new scientific findings, can be tough. But eBird makes that so easy for you.
Yeah. Basically, have to be a master of spreadsheets or databases if you yes. were doing that before eBird. But eBird is, I suppose, it's resulted in a proliferation of county birder. Like, I was talking to somebody that was visiting here last year, and she's like, I think I'm going to try for 100 species in every borough, you know, because Alaska doesn't have the counties, but we have these boroughs. And I think she was pretty close. She'd made a couple of trips to Sitka to bird or to see a rarity, and I think was pretty close to 100 species for Sitka. It's not that hard to get 100 species if you have a couple of days in the winter and a couple of days in the summer. Like, I think 100 is pretty reasonable. In other areas, maybe 100 would be more challenging. It'd definitely be seasonal and maybe needing more multiple visits. But it is, yeah, because it's so easy to track, people are like, oh, well, I filled up my county. I'll go to the next county over and the next county after that. And where you can drive, you know, that becomes a little more feasible. It's more work here, but.
Yeah, but that is another kind of carrot by being able to summarize your observations within these kind of county equivalents, these census area, borough things in Alaska. Sometimes you're like, I want to go see some in this other county, and that is increasing your survey coverage for eBird. They're kind of getting more information when you kind of spread out your observations. You could also buy lots of good observations in one location, but there's all these kind of little carrots that are provided to, hey, I want to color in my map of Alaska by seeing some birds in, you know, the Denali borough. So I'm going to travel up there and go see what I can find. And that's beneficial to eBird, beneficial to the birds there. And you kind of get a little bit out of it in the end too.
Yeah, it is. I hadn't really thought about the dispersing birder effort aspect of that sort of county listing thing. It's easy to go, oh man, those nerds who are even more nerdy than me somehow, maybe not, you know, they're nerdy in a different way. I'm a little obsessed with my local stuff, not just birds, you know, maybe they just focus on birds, but travel more. But yeah, I mean, in the end, there's very practical benefits to the data that they're gathering, especially if in Alaska and probably other places where you have rural counties where there's not that many people. Mm-hmm. So probably generally not much coverage unless you have people going there specifically, you know, they wouldn't have gone there otherwise. Kind of like Hyder in Alaska. Why would you go there unless you want to, you know, for birds? You go there because you can count it for your Alaska list, and you're going to find some stuff there that just would be very difficult to find elsewhere in Alaska. And, you know, it's easy to find further south in BC or Washington. So it's like, it's not like it's hard to see those birds, but Hyder is it because of those tricks of geography. But that gets us out in places that, you know, and the more coverage, the better from a sort of population and you know, what's moving. I think it seems like one of the things is like, how are birds moving, shifting their breeding areas, breeding ranges as, you know, climate shifts. And it seems like that's one of the things that have been documented presumably by eBird data is, you know, where are we seeing these, like, we've had more catbirds here, for example, in recent years. I don't know if their population is expanding. It may be doing that, and it may also just be a northern push of, you know, the envelope of where they, I mean, we had a successful breeding pair of catbirds here a couple of years ago, which I think was probably the first in Alaska. I can't remember. Well, I shouldn't say, I'm not 100% sure it was successful. They had young in the nest. I didn't see them fledged, but we had catbirds around. Strangely enough, there were three adults. there was the nesting pair and a third adult. I don't know why they all showed up at the same time and in the same thicket, but there they were. And there was a nest. I got pictures of the nest. And, you know, maybe that'll become more common. You know, maybe 10, 15 years from now, people will be like, oh, yeah, there's catbirds nesting. That's not unusual anymore. It seems like that's starting to happen with wood ducks a little bit, maybe.
Absolutely, yeah. There's species whose ranges are definitely expanding. And we're able to capture it better with something like eBird because everybody is a little bit of a scientist there, where historically, who knows if we would have found out that information if it would have made it to ornithological record keeping area where somebody will say, oh, you know, I saw this and I don't usually see that. But here it's all in one place and you can look at it with just three clicks on a keyboard to see how these things are changing year and year out. Yeah, Catbird is an interesting example from a vagrancy perspective. I think one that's maybe in the news a lot recently, the birding news, is song thrush in Alaska. The first one was in 2020, I believe. And then since 2020, I think maybe there was a site record a few years before that, but the first one documented was in 2020. And then since 2020, we've had multiple every year. And this is a bird that, you know, breeds in Europe. Why are we seeing this? Why are we having this sudden proliferation in number of song thrush records in the state? I don't know. This is a question that we won't have an answer for, but maybe with time, with continually people reporting their sightings and when they see these things, we might have a better clue.
Yeah. I mean, some of those patterns you like, well, could just be random, you know, and then you'll see them every year for a few years, and then like it'll go 30 years and you never see them again. You're like, I wonder what that blip was about. Or it could be the beginning of something. I mean, that's a little closer to home. Here is white-throated sparrows, which when I was first starting here early, 20 years ago, 20 plus years ago, they were really pretty unusual. And it's possible that they were just going overlooked, you know, at somebody's feeder and they didn't happen to notice. So it's always a little hard to be sure. But in recent years, they're pretty much annual in small numbers. I don't think Sitka is unique in that. I think throughout Southeast and maybe even into South Central and kind of these hyper maritime places, and even maybe even in Juneau and places that aren't quite as maritime. And it makes me wonder if, because I think, I mean, they're generally considered, as I recall, more of an East Coast species. They're common in the East and then would migrate south. But if there's a West migrating, like for whatever reason, they went the wrong way, a few of them, but if they continued being successful, like then they just kept doing that. And if there's a genetic component to that, then maybe there's getting to be, you know, the establishment of this wintering population, a separate wintering population that winters in this area. I don't know. I mean, that's like, I can imagine a story like that. And then over time, you know, maybe that happens. I don't know if they're assorted on the mating grounds or not, or if that, you know, is the very nascent bud of a potential new speciation event, you know, hundreds and thousands of years down the line or something. But it is interesting to consider that, yeah, vagrancy is kind of noise until it starts happening again and again, and it starts to become signal more, and you start to be able to ask some questions about it. You know, I don't know, but I wonder, you know.
Yeah, well, what are your thoughts on Anna's hummingbirds in Sitka? This is another species that's...
They haven't been documented nesting, but they're nesting. Mm-hmm. I mean, like, I've seen them gathering grit, which is a nesting behavior kind of thing. They're here year-round. We don't see them as much in the summer, not because they're not here, but just because the rufous hummingbirds are more aggressive and more abundant. But they're here. People love them. It's hard to get a good count on them because they move around so much and they're willing to go a fair distance, so you're not sure. But they do also seem to have feeders where they're like, these are the feeders that we hang out in. And there's different ones in different neighborhoods. I think Ketchikan had something like 50 or 60 on a bird count, you know, within the last few years. So I think they're nesting. I think they moved in the 70s. There was a push in the 70s and they disappeared. And then the first one here, I think, was 2008. They overwintered. It turned out there were two. They didn't realize that there was two. But at the end of the winter, they both showed up at the same time. So I guess potentially there was one and then one came later, but it seemed like probably there were two. They were just at one feeder. They'd left their feeder up late and then noticed the hummingbirds in like November. And so just kept refilling it. And then for a few years there, they would show up in the fall and wouldn't, sometimes would make it through the winter and sometimes wouldn't. And then I think it's probably been about 10 years that they've been consistently here year round. And they seem to have figured it out. Mm-hmm. Whether our winter's colder, well, we had some cold weather, but they seem to be able to tolerate that all right. There's insects flying most of the time. I think they can catch some insects, and probably they could find spiders and stuff and bark if they wanted to. Mm-hmm. And then people keep feeders for them. If there weren't feeders around, I don't know. I have seen a Nana's hummingbird away from town at least once. Obviously, they're traveling to get here presumably. It would be interesting. I'd love to find an S. I'm sure more than I would just love to find an S, because it's I'd say it's 95% or higher that they're nesting here, probably elsewhere in the region as well. But nobody's found that nest yet, or seen the really young birds, I guess. Again, they're probably coming out in the summer when there's lots of other things going on and it's easy to miss. But It is, I mean, they're pushing into South Central now. I don't know if they're surviving the winter there or not, but they're definitely showing up on Kenai Peninsula pretty regularly.
Increasingly like. Numbers to overwinter. Yeah. And it's a species we don't have in the summer, but migrates presumably north to, you know, Homer. We have some in Seward. Yeah, it's
are
a more
are they surviving the winter?
I believe some maybe in mild winters in marine, you know, Homer areas. But yeah, an interesting phenomenon where that species has been increasing in the winter, becoming more and more regular.
Well, and I think my understanding is before Alaska, like well before Alaska, like Anna's historical range, like 100 years ago, range was really limited in maybe Southern California. Like it just, they didn't have a big range, but they did have a pattern of dispersal. And then maybe, maybe as people did landscaping and there was more, and more people had hummingbird feeders, and they kind of figured out the human element of it. But somebody told me once that like, it also seemed like something else happened, that they were able to tolerate cold, like whether there was a genetic mutation or something, or a behavioral thing that sort of came in somewhere, because they started moving inland as well where it was colder, and they started moving much further north and then started surviving here. And I mean, it could be either, I suppose, some sort of genetic mutation or behavioral adaptation that allowed them to just basically figure it out. And once they figured it out, then like, okay, we're hanging out. And would they persist if people weren't there? I don't know. Probably not. It seems kind of unlikely, because sugar water is an awful nice form of energy for these long nights. But actually, one person told me she saw them actually feeding at night in the winter before, like at 7 at night this time of year is dark. And she'd seen a hummingbird feeding at her feeders.
At her feeder, yeah, yeah.
Yeah, at night. So maybe they don't, you know, spend the whole night asleep in this climate, you know. It's kind of a fascinating and would be interesting to be able to fast forward and see like, oh, what's the end game here in the next, I mean, not end game necessarily, what's the future game of 10, 15 years down the line?
And I think it's fascinating to kind of observe this sort of change and to kind of document it at this period, because we don't really know what's going to happen 20 years from now. What's it going to look like? So kind of every observation now is kind of valuable in order to paint a more clear picture for us.
Yeah.
In the future.
Yeah, it is. And, you know, when I think about that with respect to eBird, it's one of those kind of funny things. It's like, I know where to find Anna's hummingbirds, but I don't go look for them. So there's not that often that I have them on my eBird checklist, even though I could put them on there probably every day, especially if I had a feeder at my house that was functional. So it's like, it does make me wonder sometimes how that's reflected in the, like, if you look at the eBird records of abundance of Anna's hummingbirds in the winter, you might go, well, they're actually kind of unusual there. And I was like, well, that's because they're localized, and, you know, that's not where I'm going birding most of the time. So it is kind of funny how those sort of dynamics might play out in the data over time. And yeah, I guess I can think of some other birds, like the white crowned sparrows. Like, they're all over the place in Seattle nesting, and you're like, and they nest further north. I was like, why not here? Like, what is of like, it seems like it would be, and I know there were some that have nested, I don't know if they have been in recent years, but we're nesting in Ketchikan, kind of the Puget Sound ones. And it's like, well, maybe that's still an artifact of glaciation, where you had this split of subspecies, and the one subspecies up here and the other one's down there, and they haven't really expanded range to cover what would otherwise be suitable habitat for them. I mean, I don't know that it is, but I don't know why it wouldn't be, I guess, is because, I mean, they're common in Seattle suburbs and that kind of thing around people, so you'd think that they could do that here just as well. But so far, not in Sitka. Some in Ketchikan, and
not yet.
Yeah, not yet in Sitka. Yeah, yeah, and maybe they will. But it is kind of curious to me, like why, or some of the ducks, like they winter here, and it seems like they could nest here, but they aren't. They'll go to Yakutat or something. So there must be something that is not sufficient for them, or it's just this pattern. You know, we do have a few nesting waterfowl here, but not a lot. There's some geese, Canada geese. There's Barrow's Golden Eye nest on some of the lakes here, and Harlequin ducks, of course, and mallards. But and maybe some of the other dabbling ducks sporadically. But yeah, it seems like we don't. They mostly are going further north. Mm-hmm. Maybe there's just more food. I mean, you have a lot more mosquitoes up there, and that kind of thing. And so it is. Yeah, it does make me curious, like what's driving the ability of things to be successful in an area that, you know, to my eyes, looks like it should be fine. Obviously, they see it differently, mm-hmm. and they know better than I do, that's for sure. So,
and some of these species are, you know, they're genetically programmed to migrate. You know, it's like innate in them that this is the time of year that I become restless, and this is when I start migrating in this particular direction for this particular distance. And it's not necessarily possible for some species mm-hmm. to be like, you know what, it's kind of nice here, maybe I'm just going to lay some eggs here instead of doing this whole migration thing. It's something that maybe has to happen over a much longer time period for you to kind of see some of those changes than just being able to kind of like flip a coin and be like, okay, now I'm staying and I'm not going anymore.
Yeah, it is. I mean, even just thinking about like what observed from year to year, I can't tell you how many times I've heard people say, well, it's never been like this before. Mm-hmm. I'm like, well, I've seen it like this before not that long ago, and I know because I wrote about it at the mm-hmm. time, you know. And like our memories, like all the things that impact our memories, and then how much variation there is just naturally. And it's like, it's interesting and challenging to consider that, like, what is, you know, there's weather from year to year is variable, and that impacts, like, sometimes the birds, like one year it was such a cool summer that tree swallows were just like, yep, nope, and they left in June, and they're like, not happening this year, why bother sticking around, we're going to go to better places. And they just kind of, I think it seemed to be a completely failed nesting year here. I'm mm-hmm. sure it was fine elsewhere, but here, complete failure. Most years it's not like that. But that year it was. And then, you know, from year to year, it's like, well, sometimes it seems like there's a lot of Swainson's thrushes around, and other times less of them singing. And it's like, it's hard to know what to make of that. It's like, is that really true? Is it my observational just sort of biases and fallibility of memory? And so I guess, you know, some of this long-term structured data gathering is helpful to that end, to kind of begin to understand and make sense of, you know, what is natural variation and what mm-hmm. is actual trends. And more variation, the harder it is to find a trend essentially over time. But
absolutely. And there's certain species that is incredibly challenging for because they are nomadic, eruptive. Mm-hmm. They're hard to predict. It's hard to kind of follow or monitor trends because they don't have a place they maybe call home. They're following food resources and things like that. So, we kind of have this idea that we can do X, Y, Z, and this will provide us this, but some species have to be catered towards in very particular ways because we don't have, one-size-fits-all kind of answer to help deal with some of these things.
Well, and the finches are kind of notorious for their eruptive
finches
behavior.
Are a good one, yep.
Yeah, and the crossbills, and is there any sense of how they know where to go? Like, because you say following, but they're not really following, they're finding mm-hmm. because they're not their seeds, right? So it's not like they're following it's just where they, and sometimes it seems like there's scouts that come along, and like you'll see a couple, and then like, eating's good here, boys, let's all show up. But I don't know if there's a sense of what it is that they're able to, how it is that they're able to find and move around.
I bet it maybe works both ways, where there's pushing, you know, like
nothing.
We have
here,
no cone crop here. It's like I'm not going to be able to make it. I got to keep moving and keep roaming. And then, as you have this kind of roaming happening, then they can, with a scout per se, find these kind of resources, and then over time they all kind of start congregating at them. We had a famous example. Was it last winter or no, 2 winters ago, the most amazing finch winter in Anchorage. I think our CBC had the highest Christmas bird count, had the highest counts of white-winged crossbills ever recorded. Like, but what they were experiencing was, you know, widespread crop failure, cone crop failure in the interior of Canada. And we had pretty good cone crops in coastal South Central Alaska. So not only did you have every bird in this mass exodus out of the interior of Canada, you had them being concentrated because you had good cone crops in these particular areas. So I think it's amazing phenomenon to kind of be able to witness those sorts of eruptions. But it's also important to try to enjoy it while it lasts.
Yeah.
And not take it for granted, because it's something that won't last forever. You know, these birds, the following year, I don't think there was a single white-winged crossbill seen. So, yeah, just
white wings in particular. Red crossbills seem to be a little more reliable around here, at least. I mean, usually most years you'll see a few, mm-hmm. not always large numbers, but see or hear a few. But yeah, those white-winged crossbills, I think we had probably the same push here, not as many, but we had lots of them. They were in the late summer, early fall, they were up on Harbor Mountain, like in good numbers up towards the top of the, not, you know, at tree line and just below. And there were lots of them up there. And then when the snow came later in the winter, we had a heavyish snow in like February, and they were down on the ground at just like in number, probably, you know, hundreds of them around for, I don't know, a week or two. And they were just all over the place. So it was kind of wild. And I'd learned my lesson, because we'd had a nice arrival of white wings crossbills, like, I don't know, 15 years ago or something, and I hadn't really made much of an effort to go get pictures, and then they disappeared, like, mm-hmm. suddenly, and I was like, okay, not making that mistake again, especially if they're down on the ground where they're easy to get pictures of, because so often they're just like way up there in the trees, they're flying over, and like, not much that I can do with that. So yeah, it is fascinating. That's part of what makes birds fun. You know, they, as you were speaking earlier, they have this sweet spot of identifiability. Mm-hmm. You know, they're big enough and different enough that, you know, there are challenging ID problems, of course, but many of them are pretty tractable. Mm-hmm. Not so many of them. They also have that, you know, lottery effect of like, oh, I'm playing for the jackpot this time. You never know when you might see a Harris's sparrow and a Dick Sissel show up in your yard. And that just can happen. And with plants, you know, sort of, but not really.
Yeah, plants, salamanders, you're not going to get vagrant ones that show up because they're mammals, lost migrants.
Yeah, you might with mammals sometimes, but there's just not that many of them, and especially in North America. So yeah, birds kind of have this sweet spot of all those intersections of things that make them, you know, novel, enough novelty, enough tractability in terms of identifications. And so, yeah, that's kind of a good way to spend some time.
And that's why it's so popular, right? That's why there's so many bird watchers out there. So,
yeah. Well, and if we certainly encourage folks to join eBird if you want. But even if you don't, just like enjoy the birds around. And yeah, we're kind of getting to the end here. If anything else you want to mention before we wrap up?
No, but I think that's a good one. If you guys, if anyone out there is interested in learning about birds, it's an amazing resource. eBird, using Merlin to help you identify them. That's an app that you can download on your phone. Any way to help engage yourself with the natural world, I think, is good. And having something like Merlin to help you identify, help you learn, and then have something like eBird to help you record and help give back to is powerful.
Nice. Well, thanks for visiting with me.
Yeah. Well, thanks for having me.
You've been listening to a conversation I recorded with avian biologist and birder Zach Polin. We spoke just about 2 weeks ago, and I want to thank him for taking some time to visit with me. And thank you for joining me here on the Sitka Nature Show this week. As always, I'd love to hear what you're seeing out there, especially if it's an unusual bird. Please feel free to send me an email, sitkanature@gmail.com, or you can get on my website, sitkanature.org, and leave me a comment there. Until next time, this has been Matt on the Sitka Nature Show, KCAW, Sitka.